Let's get going here so we can get the commissioner out to get his work on. We have other things to do as well. I want to welcome everybody. Appreciate seeing the audience back today. They've learned it's good to come. Hopefully you'll learn some more things today. I can't wait to hear what the governor's cabinet has to talk about. Today we're going to take some testimony. We're going to have a few amendments and work our way through these three bills that are before us. If all goes as I would hope, we have a new clinker about the 6 o'clock closing time on Monday. I was hoping to work Monday because we got done, but we are going to come back on Monday.
Was it 4 o'clock or a half hour after session?
I think it's 4 o'clock or a half hour after session, whichever is later. And they work until about 6. If session is going, if it goes real late and there's like 20 minutes, I don't think we're going to make you come back here for 20 minutes. But I'll listen to the announcement on the floor. There's session time. We have to get this done pretty soon. And there'll be a few rough edges, which Fred Bradley likes to work out rough edges in his committee. Actually, he doesn't, but we're going to try not to. But we have to get our work done. Maybe a little fiscal note might show up or something. Just try to get it all done here. And so if we can get done Monday, if it's at all possible, I'd like to do that, at least to get to the point of voting on what we should vote on. If members have any substantial amendments they want to bring, if we can get this in by Friday, it's not a hard deadline because I don't think I'll have mine done by then, just because how we track the several bills might not be ready till Monday. But mostly for copy purposes. If you have something you want to bring and it's just not at that schedule, let me know. We've been kind of an informal group here. Cool. So let's put the minutes before we forget that. In September, I think we'd like to get a name in the minutes to approve the minutes.
Do I see one day?
You get a per diem for that, I think. So. Hearing that motion, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Yes, that's taken care of. Let's just turn over to Mr. Lutterman, and then we'll do our amendments after that. So, welcome to the committee, and
Mr. Chairman.
Nice to have you here again.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm here mostly on the information side for now, but we'll provide a lot of it, and we'll do it as fast as we can because we may have too much based on your agenda that I see here, but we'll take your instruction. Part of what we're here for is some of the parts of at least one portion of one of the bills that you've already introduced was some of the concept that we're talking about here. The governor in this State of the State address earlier today actually mentioned something about the Minnesota Advantage Plan, which you are members of. I think you have a fairly wide familiarity with that plan. We're going to talk about that briefly, but I want to do it in the context as it relates to the Public Employment Insurance Program, which is speaks to some of that legislation. I have to tell you, and you already know this, Mr. Chairman, but other members should know that we have working on some initiative relative to that. Some of that is legislative initiative, some of it is, I guess, what you'd call business oriented. In a nutshell, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to be able to strengthen the Public Employment Insurance Program, which, for your information, has actually existed in statute since 1987, was actually sold first policies in 1990, and over that period of time has basically been used and regarded as insurance of last resort for local units of government. And so it has a wide variety of plans that are customized for local units of government, and it's these are plan designs that range from zero office copays and 100% inpatient coverage all the way to $2,500 single and $5,000 family deductibles, with also some HSA compliant plans. So it's a wide range, but a fairly limited membership. In fact, membership is limited to 1,700 members currently. It only got as large as 44,000 members at any time in its history, or 4,400 members. So that gives you a perspective of what it is, but its statute has been there a long time. It is implemented. It's basically a outside of doer existence as far as the business administration. What we're going to do, and try to do, and will do, is actually offer now, for the first time, Minnesota Advantage Plan Design Benefit through PEEP. we also would be offering the same structure of Minnesota Advantage plan with a high deductible plan that is HSI compliant. Those two plans only as the new plans, but also offer the same current customer plans that are being offered through PEEP today. To be able to do that and sell that to you, I'd like to tell you why that is important, and we believe it is something that is innovative and certainly could help many local units of government in the future. I need to be able to talk about Minnesota Advantage Plan, and I do this often, early and often. I promise to do it quickly. But in your folder, I think you have a one-page, maybe at least a two-sided document. Excuse me, Representative Powell, that's not, there's more color to it, I think.
There it is.
Yes. This, in a nutshell, would describe sort of the aligned incentives that we talk about as it relates to Minnesota Advantage. This is at a high level, so it isn't every detail about what co-pays are, but it talks about the tiering and how that works. It also ties in the second or flip side of that about what is so new and innovative as it relates to anybody else in the nation, that for the first time, employees of any organization, and state employees are amongst them, they can actually look to a cost efficiency tiered arrangement and also look at the quality component. They have to do this matrix and work themselves right now, but they can look at their own clinic choices, which is how Minnesota Advantage works, look at the quality, look at their own family, and take their own feeling and their demand and their own healthcare needs. If you have asthma in your family, if you have diabetes in your family, you can look at the quality measure and say, this is the best quality care available. It's close to me. I can get it. This is the tier that I'm willing to tolerate as far as the cost implications, and make that choice. In a nutshell, there's a lot of nutshells here today, the way that Minnesota Advantage Plan has as pathways to savings are threefold. It's the information and incentives that we give to employees and their families to choose the high-quality, high-value providers. And high-value is this component that I just talked about. Get to a cost efficiency and a high-quality formula that the employee is comfortable with. It also, secondly, provides incentives for providers to change some behavior pattern, some of the way that they deliver care, to get themselves into a more attractive tier. And that is so what is unique to Minnesota and to Minnesota Advantage, so much so that even commercial product is being sold by every major health plan in Minnesota now. Also it provides the right kind of incentives and programs to use the healthcare system wisely and to protect and improve health of your family, which is what this is all about. So the utilization. And the way that we were able to achieve this zero premium growth that the governor talked about, I talk about it anytime I talk about it to anybody, is basically that alignment of incentives, so much so that the utilization of our state employees, obviously in a dynamic as it changed from 2004 to 2005, has been able to achieve this zero premium growth that is so attractive. Can that happen through a public employee insurance program, I think is the issue here today. If enough local governments purchase this Minnesota Advantage Plan, whether or not is the full-fledged comprehensive plan that state employees enjoy, or the HSA compliant plan, the more the better, but the alignment of these incentives remain intact no matter how many would join that pool. Many questions come up. I know Representative Huntley and others have asked me, or at least I know I've voiced an opinion about some of the future of healthcare as it delivers relative quality in disease management, chronic care management. I think this committee has long heard the issue of the 80-20 rule. And it is true of our state population too, that 20% of our members do use 80% of the cost. In that regard, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take a few minutes of this committee's time to hear the newest and latest and best information as it relates to CGIP, Minnesota Advantage Plan, Disease Management Program. It's fresh, it's new. I think you'll see a level of detail here that is brand new, and this is how disease management can work, and it's very innovative and how many millions of dollars can be associated with that.
If that's right.
To do that, I'm going to call on Rika Stevenson, our health risk management manager, and she's going to do this the world famous PowerPoint presentation for committees, but this is one that this committee will see, I think, for the first time. So I'll introduce you, Rika Stevenson.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape, and then when you're ready, go ahead.
Rika Sanderson. I'm with the Department of Employee Relations. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present to you some of the most exciting features of the Advantage Plan. We have a lot of material for you. It's in this packet. I'll try to go as quickly as I can because I know you're limited on time. We'd like to cover some of the highlights of the Advantage program as far as what we're doing to manage chronic disease and to implement what is called population health management in our program. Yeah. So we're briefly going to cover just an overview of Advantage healthcare costs, some of the health risk management analysis and strategies that we've done, the 2005 health assessment results, and 2006 priorities. As I'm sure you're all aware, Advantage covers all three branches of state government. There's approximately 120,000 covered lives in the group, and the program costs about $450 million a year. And for 2006, we are very pleased to be able to say Advantage had a 0% premium increase for all of the reasons that Commissioner Ludeman referred to just earlier. This next page shows just an outline of the cost of Advantage with the 0% increase, the employee share of the premium, and then the share that the state contributes. The state pays 100% of single and 85% of the dependent coverage. For 2007, we are currently projecting a 10% increase, and that's based on current medical trend. We won't know what the increase actually will be until after we see results. So just to give you some background of the kind of research we've been doing with the Advantage Plan to manage key chronic conditions, we know that costs are driven, as the Commissioner mentioned, the 80-20 rule, 80%. Costs are driven by key chronic conditions, and those chronic conditions increase with age. The average age of our state employee population is 47, and that age continues to increase. So what we are seeing is an aging population with more and more chronic disease. Our average member annual health care claims cost in 2004 was $3,167, and you'll want to keep that number in mind because we'll be looking at the costs of caring for people with chronic disease, and that number will serve as a comparison. This next slide just gives you an idea of how the pie is split up. We've got pharmacy with 22%, inpatient 20%, outpatient 17%, and physician services 40%. This is based on 2004 claims data. That's the last full year of claims data that we have. We will not get 2005 full year until towards the end of this year. So everything that we're looking at in this presentation, we're looking at three full years of claims data, so we're looking for trends in the healthcare costs. What we have seen is that pharmacy has been steadily taking a bigger piece of the pie, so we've seen that cost go up. What are some of the other large employers across the country doing to manage care in their population? This is some new survey data taken from the Mercer 2005 survey of large employers. And you can see down on the left side is listed the strategies that large employers are using to contain costs and to improve the quality of health care for their members. And all of the things that are listed here include the disease management, health risk assessments, targeted behavior modification programs, nurse advice lines, health advocate services, complex case management, and catastrophic case management. All of these are strategies that Advantage has in place or are currently working on. And you can see the increase of the general employers all moving in this direction. This next slide is shows the healthcare continuum. This is the strategy we currently have in place for Advantage. What we try to do is lay out where the membership in Advantage fits into this continuum. On the left, we have the people who are well, and moving towards the right, we move into the chronic illness and catastrophic illness. So in the Advantage plan, we've got 20% of our members who fall into the two boxes on the far right. They have chronic illness or catastrophic injuries, and that's where 77% of our costs are currently being spent. The other 80% of the membership falls across those first three boxes, and underneath each of the boxes, those are the strategies that we have in place, the strategies and interventions to reach that particular group of individuals. So in the well category, we're focusing on prevention, screening, things like the flu shot campaign and promoting healthy lifestyles. In the at-risk category, where there's a lot of stress, obesity, high cholesterol, physical inactivity, we've implemented health risk assessments, targeted risk reduction programs, and focus on mental health and stress management through programs like the EAP or Employee Assistance Program. And as we move to the right in the chronic illness, that's where things like disease management and patient advocacy services come into play. So all of these things are things that we're currently working on to help manage costs and to improve the care for members in the Advantage program. So the need for care management is that care management focuses on immediate and long-term member health improvement. We know a significant number of state employees have chronic disease, and the number of those members continues to rise. Next page on the key conditions. This outlines the conditions that we believe are driving the costs in our population. You can see that for asthma, for example, 4% of the members have a diagnosis of asthma, but they use 8% of the costs. The other conditions listed are also conditions that we target to just watch the trends in those. We're especially concerned about the rise in diabetes type 2, which is the adult onset diabetes that can be controlled a lot by lifestyle choices and lifestyle behaviors. Also, the significant percent of costs that we see going to mental health, especially depression and other mental health conditions. And then, of course, the cardiac, both of the cardiac categories are very high cost in our group. So members in the Advantage plan that had one or more conditions continues to increase over the year. 36% of the members have one or more of those conditions in 2002, and that has risen in 2004 to 38.2% of the members.
Excuse me, some of the members had more than one condition. Is that why it doesn't equal?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for asking that. There is double counting in this, so people can be in more than one category. This next slide shows the number of Advantage members with key conditions. You can look at the three-year trend. We see diabetes type 2, the hypertension cholesterol category, and the heart categories are increasing in prevalence each year. The per member per year cost of these key conditions is on page 11. You can see that the heart conditions are especially high cost. Those costs are rising significantly. Also, both of the diabetes categories, type 1 and type 2. In the chart at the bottom of the page, you can see that the average number of key conditions for members with each of those conditions. So, for example, if you look at the heart, coronary heart disease, on average, the member with coronary heart disease has 3.1 of the conditions on this page. And if you look at the box on the bottom, it's talking about the cost trend. And diabetes type 2 is rising at a rate greater than the other conditions, and that's the type of diabetes that we really want to promote, the healthy lifestyle choices, so that we can have an impact on that. Page 12 lists the types of care management support programs that we have in place for Advantage members out of the conditions listed there. The health plans are offering disease management programs to that are optional voluntary programs for members. We do have quite high participation in most of the programs. Right now there's about 23,000 state employees and their dependents who are participating in one of these programs or more. The first full year that we had the programs in place, we did have a very excellent return on investment. We did see decreases in inpatient admissions and emergency room visits for managed members compared to those who are not in participating in one of the programs. Also, we've done continual member satisfaction surveys on these programs, and they get very high ratings from our members who really appreciate the support that they get and the information that allows them to have those kind of conversations with their providers on their care. This is another slide from the Cleveland Clinic Health System research that they've done on the rate of depression, and that's one of the key areas that we're targeting to do depression awareness and working with the employee assistance program to help identify those who have undiagnosed depression and to connect them with the right resources to get help. And this just shows the rate of depression with the key conditions that we're seeing in our population. So it's a serious concern for us. As you probably know, we implemented health assessments this past year for Advantage, and this health assessments was somewhat controversial with some people, but it was a topic that was explored with the Joint Labor Management Committee that we're a part of with the unions. And the entire year prior to implementation, we talked about what were some of the strategies that we could put in place to help employees to create awareness of lifestyle issues and behavior that impacted healthcare costs. And this was something that we explored in depth with them. We brought in health plans. We talked about member privacy. We were all very concerned about the confidentiality of the data and how it was going to be handled with the health plans. So we did an in-depth exploration of all those issues, and we all felt that this was an intervention that would be helpful with our population to help address and create awareness of health issues so that we can have an impact on the employees that are moving up that health continuum and moving into the areas on the right into chronic disease. That's where we want to prevent that from happening. So this was a fairly low cost and widespread way to reach a lot of the members of the plan. So we had 47,000 employees eligible to take the assessment. 34,500 took it, which was a 73% participation rate, which we felt was excellent for the first year. The major risk factors identified by the health plans, they did provide us with an aggregate summary of what our group's risk factors are. Nutrition, weight, stress, and physical inactivity. What their reports have told us is the modifiable or excess costs in our group amount to about $80 million. So that's the dollar amount that they feel could be impacted if employees make lifestyle changes and address some of the issues like the weight and physical inactivity. Health plans also reported to us that 66% of the state employees are overweight or obese, 35% have heart disease or diabetes or are at high risk of developing. There is a significant number of women with family history of breast cancer who had not had a mammogram. 87% of employees have three or more major risk factors, and And the latest report that we've gotten is that over 2,000 employees have enrolled in some type of follow-up health improvement or coaching program, which indicates they're at a stage where they're ready to make a behavior change. They want to lose weight, they want to start an exercise program, or they want to deal with stress management. So we're really happy and excited about those results and looking forward to more participation in these types of programs.
What was the average score, do you know? A good idea, that's what I did.
Well, we were fairly high, a high-risk group. The average age group that filled out the health assessment was like the 50 to 59 group. So we had a lot of, you know, risk factors for chronic disease. We were lower in smoking than was predicted for our group, which was good, but there were a lot of ex-smokers. So I think by that age, a lot of people have decided that they're going to quit. But we do have, you know, our age group is older than a lot of other large employers, so we are dealing with more chronic disease. We didn't have things like alcohol abuse or tobacco abuse, though, in our top five risk factors, which younger age groups may have had. And just to give you an idea of some of the priorities we have for 2006, continued work on health improvement and care management. We'll be looking at new strategies, already preparing for the next round of bargaining with the unions. We have a full agenda talking with them year-round about things that we can add to the program to help manage the health of the population. We also have targeted initiatives for depression awareness scheduled for this year. We are continuing with the statewide worksite flu shot campaign, which has been very successful. And as specific outcomes of the last round of labor negotiations, we are currently in the RFP process, negotiating with a vendor to provide patient advocacy and a best-in-class provider network for Advantage. And we will be also issuing an RFP for a pharmacy benefit manager for Advantage later this year. Are there any questions I can answer? I know I went through this very quickly, but just wanted to give you a feel for some of the things that we put in place.
I have a couple, and I know members do too. With this, since on the PVM thing, how long would that? Was that an annual contract to renew, or do they get 3 years, or what would that be, do you think?
Currently, each of the three health plans we work with uses their own PBM. However, during the last round of bargaining, we discussed the possibility of looking at a single pharmacy benefit manager that would go across all three plans. So we will be issuing an RFP to find out whether or not that would be advantageous to us.
We'll keep them, and the contract will be for how long? 2 years? Cal backing out a number there.
Well, that depends on the response to the RFP.
I mean, is it what's typical? One, two, three?
Pattern of contract.
Oh, it's a 2 year cycle for the TPA is on a 2 year cycle and everything is 2 years. I suppose that's
probably, yes.
Just curious. Left some teeth in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your data on members, do you break that down by age at all or by any demographic categories?
Yes, we do.
Can we get that?
Could you give me an idea of what you'd be interested in?
I can send a letter in.
Okay.
That'd be great. Thank you.
We have more data than...
That'd be great.
Yeah.
And Bradley.
I'm sure. First question was back when you said about 10%, I think, was the projection for 2007. And I'm sort of curious. I mean, I realize this is kind of preliminary, but it's discouraging, of course, because I think we'd all like it to be a lot less. But I'm assuming, well, maybe you can help. Just, you know, what do you look at, and what are you, this is looking at the raw healthcare costs, or are there some other factors that you bring in? Because this is what you're assuming would be what we would see as premium increases. State employees would see as premium increases. Well, maybe just a little bit about how you arrive at the 10%.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to address the entire question, but it's my understanding that 10% is a projection just based on what current medical trend is nationally. We are always a couple of years behind because we don't have a full year of claims data until late in the following year. So, for example, right now we have 2004. We have the actual costs from 2004, and those are used to project 2 years from now. They're taken into consideration. So, that 10% for now is just a projection. The actual number won't be known until later on. You know, by the end of this year, we'll have 2005 costs.
There's some badly thought,
yeah. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up with that.
Yeah,
you know, it's particularly stressful because I can understand why you're getting recognition because this is really comprehensive and I think is well thought out what you've been doing. And part of it then would mean, as you said, you're getting a return on investment, which is fascinating. By the way, I'd love to follow up a little bit more specifics on that return on investment, how it breaks out and so forth, because some of us are trying to encourage, of course, these kinds of strategies in other places, but as a business person, you don't do it unless you get something for it. And what that means to me, anyway, is that because I believe a lot of these things are giving some return, 10% is even worse. Because I'm assuming that your strategies are dragging some things down, and the 10% must be a net.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, well, you're right, of course. However, to convince an actuary that medical trend doesn't exist generally, no matter what interventions are in place, is difficult. And put us in a position until we get, like, for example, reserves data about the growth or the decline of reserves in 2 years past to instruct us about what we would do 2 years hence is the difficulty here. And so in the negotiations process, which is well before the calendar year, we're now 2.5 years ahead, and just for a self-funded fund to be able to protect itself against what the world of actuaries, not just ours and the unions, the world of actuaries is setting medical trend in 2007 at somewhere at 9.8% to 10.2%. So that wouldn't have to do with these interventions. It's simply that whatever these claims come in would be at that sort of level. I think we're going to beat that. I'm very optimistic about that, but we cannot protect our fund without assuming that actuarial trend.
And Mr. Chair, final question then. Maybe it's just more of a comment. I can understand you've got to be a bit conservative to protect. What I'm wondering in some respects is as we get this kind of data, we get return on investment, whether or not we begin to see amongst actuaries and insurers. Matter of fact, I mean, the good part would be just like 55 Alive, you actually, if you do it, the insurance company will actually give you that some of these kinds of things would actually translate as you're negotiating an insurance package to say, if you do this, we're going to give you that much reduction in rates or whatever else it may be. Are you seeing any indication of that in the negotiations that some of these things are plugging in?
No, at the level of, you're talking about two levels of negotiation, and our negotiations with health plans is one level of negotiation.
Plans, that's
one. And with the state employee groups is a whole different table. And we do have return on investment information that Rick can share with you about millions of dollars of savings that she just talked about. And that is in the rate setting. But the rate setting is not done by the health plans. We are self-insured. We have the control over that. So while we like to blame health plans, and we have good carriers, a good relationship, we like to blame them for a lot of this. This is not the place to blame them.
The bills.
That's right.
All right. If you could follow up on the return investment.
Yes, we can get you more information.
Mr. Chair, and either the commissioner or Ms. Stenerson. On the pharmacy benefits manager, currently each plan has their own company and that does it. And in the new one, are you going to be paying that company to do the pharmacy benefit management, or and how does that relate to what you pay the plans? Are you going to get a reduction then if you're paying for it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Humming, first of all, we're still in the development of the RFP, so there's no commitment, no decision has been made about that. The only decision was with at the bargaining table that we would actually put out an RFP. So whether we do it or not is still a question. Yes, they have either through their own system or in connections with the Blues, which has a more collective PBM, other plans, carriers that we have sourced that out to other PBMs, so it's complicated. But yeah, basically, we're self-insured. We pay
either way.
So it, the pharmacy claims have to be paid, and how they are paid is what this issue is about. Are there enough collected savings to go to a single? That's what the RFP is all about, to find discover that. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, I wonder.
Well, obviously, there would
be a discount.
Major.
That the three plans charge you now.
Yeah,
they're not going to do that anymore.
I don't want to negotiate that here.
Maybe some things you shouldn't talk too much.
Let's just raise that expectation now, though.
Mr. Chair, when we get back to PIPA, I'll have some additional questions.
I think we'll go back to that topic after we finish this. That's kind of Paul.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley fleshed this out pretty well, but I also was rather surprised with the projected increase for the 2007 year on the premiums. Given the fact what we've seen, I just saw 2005 rates nationwide being less than 8% on premium, and increases on HSA being less than 3% increase for 2005. So this is a surprise. Is it a more of a function? We're an older group, as I noticed on one of your one of the slides here, pharmacy costs being 22%. That seems to me to be fairly high. So, is it more of an age function of age of the group?
Which one, Ms. Sanderson?
I was just going to say, it is partly a function of the age of the group, because even though we have proven return on investment and savings, we continue to see new people that are moving into that chronic disease category, and usually it's with a major catastrophic event like a heart attack or a stroke, which has very high costs attached to it. So as much as we're doing to then manage that person's care once they have the illness and help them to get better, we still keep seeing people moving into those high-cost categories. That's why we're trying to look at the lower end of the continuum and develop things that reach people before they get up there. Also, you know, the 10%, we're dealing with very conservative actuaries. We have to rely on them to set the rates for us. So it's always better to have good news if it's not that afterwards than to not have enough money there to pay the bills.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and Representative Powell, the money's never lost if the rates are set too high. These end up in the reserves. I mean, you could say that we've overtaxed or over-premiumed the group. Mostly these are state agencies that are paying most of these premiums, by the way. But the money is not lost. It goes into the CGIP reserves for future levels of... So setting them, it doesn't have that risk of saying, we simply set premiums, we paid somebody, and the money disappeared. That is not true. We're self-funded.
Speaking of reserves, how much do you reserve?
We're healthy. We try to stay between the 12% and 16%, and we're.
We have $100 million in reserves.
No, we do not, Mr. Chairman.
Oh,
that would be 25%.
Okay. I have a couple questions. I'm just noticing, to your credit, I just did a quick math on here that your per member per month over your system is about $312 per member per month if you divide what's the 120,000 into 450 million. Which is cheaper than Minnesota Care, which is 340 or something per member per month. And that's this interesting thing. Does that seem reasonable to you? Does 312 per member per month sound like the price? It's just a math problem that I...
done the math, Mr. Chairman. I trust it, but it sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know about the Medicare experience.
But I mean, just to compare, that the Medicare benefit is far less superior. far less superior. I'm a politician. It's just, it's a poor benefit than what you provide with that. Of course, there's
co-pays.
There's co-pays, and it's closer to first.
There are also in Medicare.
I'm not going to go there.
But it's just an interesting thing that this, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. So.
I would remind, and Representative Powell spoke to this too, Mr. Chairman, that we openly admit that because of our age, we're about 30% higher premium cost than similar Best Buy group. For
example. Yeah. Why don't you revert back to your PEEP discussion?
Well,
let me ask you some questions about that.
Mr. Chairman, I guess there is language being proposed, and I can't speak specifically about what the governor's budget proposal is or what it would look like today, but I'd know more tomorrow or Monday, apparently, but this is the idea that PEEP is administered well enough, it has got statute good enough, it could be strengthened, as you and I have spoken about, but the idea that it also has reserves, it's a self-funded, it's a shared pool environment. I don't know if everyone understands that, but there is some pooling risk at the local level, and then some shared pooling for no matter how many are in PEEP. And this is to offer this exact same plan to PEEP.
Right. And so you were talking about two different plans.
Okay, this is the comprehensive plan. This is what the state employees, legislators, the governor.
Your buck deductible, and is that what we have now?
It's the tiered arrangement. Yeah. It could be as low as $30 if you're in tier one and single.
What about the form? So I got the.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. excuse me, but the other plan, Mr. Chairman, and this is not to be changed. This is the, part of the problem with PEEP, it was getting too customized and too expensive. But it's very similar to the tiered arrangement here with a co-insurance tiering system and then the high-end deductible, a high deductible relative to the tiers. And so then it's HSA compliant. We do not answer, and people would not answer this question about who would establish the savings account. Is that me? Who would establish the savings account, nor who would contribute to it, whether it be the employee or the employer.
You don't care, just get the money, right?
Well, I care as much as the employees care, but that's the decision to be made somewhere else.
Yeah, the group would come in having decided that and just advise it.
We've done a considerable amount of actuarial and consulting work on this. We're fairly confident, and I can tell you this committee today that on the comprehensive plan, it is going to be priced fairly similar to the state employee group. And this has to be priced with a premium that has enough reserve contribution for the business stability of the group. I can tell you that the HSA compliant plan looks like it will be pretty competitive.
And you get that's a 2,000 deductible thing, or is it 1,000, or what were you?
That is in the tiered arrangement, so that high deductible goes up as you go to a higher tier.
Oh, I see.
And so the contribution that has to be made to the savings account, either by the employer has to go higher, and your exposure goes higher as you go to a higher.
And the range of that, is that something you know exactly? Is that 1,000 to 3,000, or did you?
I think
that.
About it? No, it has.
I
think
it's. Mr. Helden. Just about at least.
I think 1,100 was the tier one. I think that's the minimum to get to a high deductible plan, and I think the high end is high.
4,000.
Something like 4,000 or more.
50.
Hmm?
52, I think.
5,200? Mr. Huntley knows more.
Mr. Huntley,
yeah. Yeah, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, trying to understand this PEEP proposal. The state is, in its Minnesota Advantage, is self-insured.
I see.
Would this PEEP program be a self-insured program? And if it is, who's taking the risk?
Currently is. We have the PEEP manager here, Scott Anderson. If you get too technical on me, I'm going to hand it over. But yes, it's a self-insured pool. Currently is. It has reserves. It has high premiums.
So, Commissioner, right, I think that this has been very enlightening. I have one more question, then if there's more questions, I think we'll have to move
in.
Pretty nice evening outside. Not that I should tell the rest of the people in this room that.
Well, we all want to work on fitness, too.
When people come in, because you...
That's right. Can I interrupt you one more time?
I think I have one more question, but go ahead.
Okay. I think we got some unabashed promotional materials about the opening of our Minute Clinic, which happened yesterday. It's in the ground floor of the Centennial Building. Just remind you, even as members of the plan, you're welcome to come over there. On the back of one of those things tells you the sort of things that they do. These are at advertised prices, and this is an insurance-eligible event.
45 seconds about the Minute Clinic. That's pretty good.
At a $10 copay. So
when people would join in the PEEP offering,
yes,
when they come in, they wouldn't have to bring reserves with them because you have reserves, so they would just come in paying par to start with and not at the front end load. Or do you have an idea about that yet?
This is one of the major issues that we've been talking about. The popularity of the plan can't necessarily be predicted from the get-go.
Right.
And so if so many members join so fast without bringing the reserves to them, and the reserves have to come through the premium, this is at a slower rate than is actuarially safe.
It'll become uncomfortable.
Yes. So you'll see in some of the legislation that is still in the revisor's office being worked on, some of the language you'll be familiar with, some of the new ones, is that the commissioner probably has to have the authority to regulate entry into approval to make sure that it's business sound. Yes.
What's going to help me?
Probably for the gentleman behind you that runs PEEP.
Okay. And I think we have to. We have a lot more witnesses, so if maybe you want to chat in the hallway or something.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wanted you to be familiar with some of the initiatives.
This is wonderful. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate
Mr.
your
Chairman.
Time. Let me see who's on the list here. Mr. Bartsch, why don't you come up here and be dangerous here and be laughing. We spent a fair amount of time on this topic, but I think this was very productive for all of us, and I'm not apologizing for it because this is very substantive. For those of you who are going to still be testifying today, I think we can get through most of you at least, especially if you're going to keep to your point and if members ask enough questions, but not actually... I do have an amendment I want to offer today, too, just to get that get the bill in order that you can spend the weekend thinking about it. Mr. Bartsch, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you tell us today.
Of the division. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch. I'm here today representing Health Partners. I was asked to come here today and a bit embarrassed. I'm excited to talk about small group rating to give the committee a little background. And Mr. Pender is going to help me out and correct me whenever I misstep. As he is sort of the resident expert on this and all insurance topics. So I did bring a handout. I know he has one as well, and I checked mine, and it's not too different from his, so I feel a little bit better. And I'll be very quick in this, and then I do have some comments about the bill.
Go ahead, yeah.
Thanks.
Can you kind of give us a 5-minute summary?
Yeah.
Okay, that'd be good. And then if Mr. Pender wants to chime in there,
And
I really see prepared a 20-minute speech, but...
I'm a lobbyist, so I could talk for 20 minutes, but...
we won't let you.
The
door opens up at 6 minutes, so...
First thing we need to remember is that small groups are different than large groups, and they're rated differently, and there's a reason for that, which we'll get to in a second. But small groups are defined as groups between 2 and 50 employees. As insurers, we separate small groups and we pool the risk of the small groups together. And this is done because, as I'm going to talk about, there's different rules in small group and how you rate, and they're treated differently. The reason small groups are defined separately is because their small size makes them more volatile to experience change. This is something I'm sure all you're familiar with people in your districts. Small groups, someone gets cancer and their rates can go through the roof dramatically quicker. They don't have the ability to spread risk like a large group, as this 200 does. So that's why there's special rules for a small group. Besides the rating rules that are on the sheets, there are some other rules with small group. Small group coverage is guaranteed issue in the state. If you're a small group, if you're a small employer, we have to write you, and you can take that coverage. So there's guaranteed issue and there's guaranteed renewability, which means if you have coverage under us, we can write you in your policy and you can keep it. Those are important things to remember. So the handout, when you're setting or adjusting small group premiums, the first thing we do as a health plan is we take, again, that larger small group pool, all the small group we have, and we set what's called an index rate. And the index rate is just basically the average rate we set for anyone in the small group. After we set that index rate, we look at how we're allowed to vary each group beyond the index rate by a factor of 25% up or down. Those are what's called the rate bands. So we set our index rate at 1, and we can look at each small group based on their experience and rate them at 0.75 of that index rate up to 1.25 of that index rate. And again, those are called the rate bands. We can't vary anyone in the small group above or below those numbers, even if their expected health risk would suggest or encourage us to do so. Once we set them within those rate bands, we can then factor in age of the group. We can look at the individuals and the age and adjust for the age of the group. And then also location. There are different geographic regions in the state that for various factors you can have slight grading variances in them. All those things go into setting the rate for the small group. There's one other thing of importance to remember in small group rating, and that is from year to year, we cannot adjust a small group based solely on their experience, more than 15% within the rate bands. So I'll walk through that. Your index rate will go up, but if you are a small group who's at 1, you're the average, okay, your index rate will go up 8 to 10%. We cannot bump you up within those rate bands more than 15% in 1 year. And that was a law that was passed about 3 years ago in the state in an effort to alleviate some of the pressures that small groups would have seeing high rate increases based on their health expectancy. So I try to do that quickly. I don't know if I confused anyone. A lot of that information is on the sheet that I handed out, and Mr. Penner will be happy to correct me where I misspoke.
So the increase could be more than 15% or 15% plus 8?
Not 15%. The index rate will go up regardless. Right. Remember, you always have to start with the index rate. So all small groups move with each plan's index rate. After that index rate is set, we cannot adjust your experience. We cannot move you within the rate bands more than 15% in a given year.
So if the trend is 8, it could be 23? Is that as simple as that?
Correct. And then you also have to factor in their age variation. If the group gets older, those factors can go into account too.
The commonly age rate in that small group?
I'm sorry, can
you age rate groups,
yep,
as well?
Yep, a different sector, 0 to 18, 18 to 24, 30 to 40. And we have, for example, about 10 different age groups you rate on. Couple things to remember with small groups and why you ask we have the rate bands. The reason is to protect especially those sicker small groups. That's why the rate bands were to put in place. And it's hard to think about it this way, but the really sick small groups have one of the best insurance deals in town. That is, even though they're very sick, their increases from year to year can only go up that index rate. You can't move them from their experience any higher than the top of the rate bands. And so they're getting a better deal. The flip side of that is the person at the low end, the really healthy small group, we're never going to be able to give him a rate as low as he would normally expect because he's so healthy. He's always got to subsidize the group at the top.
That could be minus 25%.
-25%, correct. So there's just a little background on small group rating that, again, I was a little embarrassed that I was having to give. If I can talk quickly about
this is very interesting. You should be pleased to give a nice little presentation.
Thank you very much. Quickly about some of the proposals that the chairman has brought forward. House Bill 2832, the reinsurance pool. Just as background, there was this discussion about this last week, but health partners, we do reinsure our small and large groups for claims between $1 million and $3 million. So we do purchase reinsurance to cover our groups. It's a very competitive market. Last time we sent out an RFP, we got numerous responses. We even have groups coming to us when we're not soliciting bids, offering bids to us, trying to get our business. And our rates for reinsurance are not increasing anywhere near the rate of normal health care claims.
So the trend is below?
Yes. Yes.
You would ask that question.
From our experience, it's well below. And it's a long way of saying, you know, I don't believe there's a need for a statewide reinsurance pool, although I do understand what your thought process was in coming up with this idea. The other thing I would suggest is that we really don't want to, in this proposal and some of the others, be taking money out of the health care access fund as either startup costs or loan costs for these types of ideas. I don't believe, and we don't believe, that's why the health care access fund was created or why you and other providers are paying provider tax. And so we suggest that. On the MEEP and PEEP proposals, A peak in and of itself, as the commissioner explained, is a pool that's run. It's for public employees. It's run by the Department of Employee Relations. They're self-insured. They can largely do what they want to do, other public employees. So if PEEP wants to reinvent itself, you know, we wish them the best of luck, and if they ask for our help in doing it, obviously we're going to help them try to do it. MEEP, on the other hand, is a little bit different animal. And MEEP, I don't think is going to work. And in fact, I think we have evidence that shows that, because we've tried MEEP and it didn't work. And all of the concerns about pooling really are an example with MEEP. Adverse selection, not being able to get enough lives into the program, duplicating administrative costs. All of these things, I think, were reasons why MEEP never got off the ground in the first place, and I would submit that they're reasons that MEEP is not going to continue, even if you try to restructure the program as we've done here. I think if you look at the examples that Doris talked about in CGIP, what some of the plans are doing out in the marketplace as far as combating chronic diseases, as healthy behaviors, that is the realm and that is the world where we want to go to as far as getting people healthy so they can have lower health care costs, which in turn creates lower insurance premiums. The one area I would suggest is we look at the examples from CGIP and DUR. Again, they talked about health assessments, disease management, getting people healthy, and this is the area you want to focus on. All of the programs that we offer and they offer are programs that are offered to people with insurance coverage. And so your efforts to try to get people covered at any level is the right way to go about this. I would suggest that there are many products in the marketplace that we and other plans offer relatively inexpensive, and that's a relative term depending on how much income you have, but there's more we can do. If I'm an 18 to 24-year-old, I'm still not purchasing a $200 product. As an HMO in the state, I'm still limited in what type of product I can offer that individual as far as having a high deductible, as far as a product with a lifetime maximum. I can't offer him as cheap a product as he might want to buy to get him into the insured pool. We want that healthy risk into the pool. So anything that this body and others can do to relieve some of the limits that are placed on HMOs, particularly in offering products to people in the marketplace, I think will be of great help in getting healthy people into the risk pool and making sure people have access to the types of healthy behavior programs that were talked about by the Department of Employee Relations.
Give a specific list of those.
I can certainly bring them forward for you.
If you mind, yeah, that'd be that's quick enough. I'll be here in the morning. We're talking about some of those.
Okay.
Senator Huntley.
Jeff, Mr. Chair, first.
Yeah. Whatever.
Small group rate setting. If you allow age adjusting, what I'm trying to understand is how a group in Willow River can get up to 20,000 plus for family coverage.
Mr. Chair, and
if there's a rate band there,
Representative Huntley, I think this is the example that you used last week. Is it a small school district? I'm not sure if they fall within the 2 to 50 employee group. I don't know that they do or not. I would have to submit that if they are below 50 employees, they are subject to the rate bands. Depending on the product that they purchase, if it's got a very generous benefit set, and depending on the overall age of the group, I mean, they could be very highly rated, even within the rate bands, their year-to-year experience, like I said before, would still only be capped at the index rate. If you look at, for a similar product, what the youngest and healthiest group for that product could be rated versus the oldest and sickest group, it's a 1-to-5 ratio for the same product. And so there can be extreme variation for the same product within the rate band. But I'm not sure if the example you gave last week, if they fall within that group. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me offer my amendment while the while Ms. Elliott comes up and just prepares to get settled in. We establish the claim. I would like to move this amendment today to get it so people know we're really going to offer it. We're going to be voting on the whole bill, likely by sections. There may actually be another DE-8-2, I would expect, that will appear before us on Monday. Mr. Pender can put that together, which will incorporate all this so it'll be clear what we're going to do. Let me tell you what I'm doing here. And I wish the members are here, but they're not, and so they'll get to look at this. But it's there's a few things. Some of these are controversial. Some are just great ideas. Some are great ideas that are controversial. With Mr. Bartsch's testimony about getting more people into insurance, I am inspired. In fact, that's my new zeal, is to keep people in group coverages. The first part of it has to do with a bill I just introduced today, I think, allowing dependents to be continued to age 25. And what I'd like to hear, not at this minute, but over the course of time, is if we need to have language to allow for a plan, this would be a single dependent and not a married one, and if we should allow you to adjust the rate of that particular person based upon that. That's what I'd like to know, but I think there's some way to go on this, and I talked to one group today and they didn't mind it at all, at least they didn't see it as a big problem. But tell me where this is practical. I think there's some mileage in this, especially since the 21 to 25 group is about your cheapest one. It does add some lives, and if it does increase the cost, I think that in many cases the family member would be willing to pay the incremental cost for the one additional person. So, discussion about that for members. And then the next, or is that all? The whole page one time is that. All the one to up to 122 is all that.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Okay, so that's all that does. The second part is what I talked about with electronic billing assistance. Commerce has to be relieved as well. I didn't mean to include health department. So we're just going to make sure that Siemens services that would help with electronic billing for the small providers, especially thinking about the state plans. So they can then fiscal note that accordingly. I would expect that would save money. Because as a provider who doesn't know how to electronic bill, they get boxes of papers. And they have to read these boxes of papers with some scanner device, and they don't like me filling one little box around and they mail it back. So my poor office manager, I keep begging her to go electronic, and she's nervous about it. So that's how I even thought of this. But I got to think there's a lot of clinics across the state who just have no idea how to do that. The next section, page 2-1 on the second page, is inserting, this has to do with the pharmacy price reporting, or pharmacy, we discussed this a little bit. We've had the session where the pharmacy lists their own price, not just their maybe usual customer across the chain. And this is where the pharmacy board would be included in reminding the pharmacist that they need to follow the law about this. In the bill, we have required the boards to remind providers to have disclosure. And what I haven't heard yet from the governor's office is some new idea they're going to have more disclosure. I'm eager to see what more might be. I think our bill is quite germane to that improvement. And if this bill goes, as it moves forward, I would expect we'd probably add in some disclosure language where the bill happened to be tracked at the time. So you can expect that. That being said, I'm trying to make any major changes to this bill. Half of them will stay here, and some things will come up along the way, and it would be unavoidable, but we'll do those with proper notice. It could be repealed, huh? 2-2 to 2-4.
Mr. Chair, that's a provision of the law that relates to the things we're doing on the dependent coverage. Okay. It's eliminating a definition that's not needed anymore.
All right, so that's the amendment. Any questions about the amendment? I'd like to add this to the DE-8-2 if I need discussion about this. Seeing none, all in favor, say aye. All right, opposed. Adopted. I'll accept comments in my office about some of those things. And I do want to offer, while everybody is still here, because I just have a feeling people start to fit away, I wanted to make it clear to the, especially the body at large and the members here, what I intend to bring forward on Monday as just a general idea about the bill. With all regrets to the state fiscal imbalance these days, we need more money. if I tell you I'm not going to do the reinsurance bill, that will actually decrease the state coffers, because the lobbyists will quit working on that. We'll quit doing, we see the tax revenue on their salaries. But I've been persuaded that there is indeed a robust reinsurance market in the state. Where I do see the problem, and I am convinced there is yet a problem, is in some startup. If there were a new co-op or a new NEEP or a new some entity wanting to come forward and get reinsurance, that they would have it be hard-pressed to find reinsurance. I can be assured in my office and in the hallway that there are reinsurers eager to write policies for groups of 100, even if there were only 100. And so that I will take their word at that for now. And if I discover in the future that that's not the case, then we'll revisit that reinsurance deal and go there, and I'll be less trusting about that testimony. But I think that for now, but I do also want to mention that in the reinsurance world, I did want to do something there, and I'll be working with various individuals to incorporate the Sikora bill into this bill, which is the pooling reinsurance by the co-op. And just for due diligence about that little nuance, there's a few other pieces which are not ready, but I wanted to tell you what I'm thinking about just so we work in the light of day here, is that I'm told that the co-ops currently reissue their RFPs for their TPAs every 5 years, and we'd be sure that's clarified in the statute. And then the reinsurance seems to be the trend. The common thing is to do it every year. So I think that might be part of the price to pay. And in return for giving the co-ops that more authority, I think that they should be willing to give data to their members if they need to shop. I remember I'm interested in the market. And I think that will address some of the concerns that have come up and yet give the co-ops a lot of flexibility. In the PEEP world, it would be my intention to leave PEEP happily, and it's the acronym always makes you want to laugh. in it doer with some significant improvements. They need to be able to recapture dollars from people who haven't paid, which seems that they're unable to do that now, which seems really a bad thing. The penalty for not paying is you get kicked out and you don't have to pay, which is a pretty cool deal. But then the survivors have to pay, which is why it's so challenged. I will be whatever language the department comes up with to facilitate their HSA and their comprehensive offerings, I will talking to a few of you. I think the board needs some work, and I've been tentative about even touching all that collective bargaining language for fear of making this a Pell committee, which I do not want to do. But if that could be made to be improved to reflect those who might seek it, it becomes, I think, a valid option for some counties and townships, schools, or whomever would want to use it and be enabled. My view is that probably the people should be asked to pay three times going into it to solve the reserve issue, because I'm not comfortable taking the money from the health access fund. I just put that there for a placeholder. One of us has gotten most of that, and I still just want to play with MEEP a little bit, and it may not be viable. But it seems to me, also in MEEP, I'd like to make it, I'm going to propose that we allow nursing homes to pull into that. My desire to get more people into group plans. There's some, maybe some controversy to that. Tell me where I'm wrong. But if they would pay rates that are, these people are have nowhere to go. And if the alternative is Minnesota Care, which I remember from our data, it was $240 or so per member per month on the subsidies. The stated plan is $312, and they could probably, it's just interesting to me that that would give them maybe somewhere to go, and they could then bargain their way in with whatever contributions. At least to give them that option. Again, all my joining options on all my MEEP and PEEP stuff acronyms again, are all or none. You can't bring one member of a nursing home or the administrative staff only. You have to bring everybody in if you offer a plan. The city wants to offer a plan, et cetera. But they would bring everybody or none. Is that the heart of... This will be an amendment, but I just want you to know what there is so you don't come back really surprised and you have to see if your state employees... Well, you aren't. So it wouldn't affect my plan, but you know, state employees don't want to increase our health costs, and your employer doesn't want to have to bear paying for heart attack treatment. You know. Maybe a work comp thing which would drive rates and keep people out of the state, if you remember that. Have I forgotten any of the regular, most of the details of that? In the PEEP stuff? think that's the high point. So
most of it, Mr. Chair.
Then MEEP, I still, the trouble with MEEP that I see, and I really like the idea of it, is how do you find enough people? When you push the start button, how do you get people to go there? And the nursing home piece, I'm putting a 10-year sunset on that opportunity. So by then, there would be a group in their own right, perhaps, if they could even just spin themselves up or give them MEEP to make it for that, or they could... some kind of a... It's been 10 years of an eon around here, so at least that way gives them somewhere to go, and they can have some hope of where to go, because they're kind of quasi-public employees anyway. Every dollar that they get in those systems comes from most of the feds. So, and then with the MEEP, and these bills will go different directions, I would expect. You might see 3 or 4 bills being spun out of here. The ambulance insurance, if we keep that in, would... maybe write us in their own little bill going off the civil law to face an uncertain future. Maybe without recommendation, we can keep it alive that far. If it doesn't go, it doesn't go. The keep stuff would likely be the province of the state government finance. The MEEP and whatever other commerce, so their bills might go on a bill to commerce. After these would all go through the health committee then. And there might be one of the bill, I don't know. But that's my general thought, just so you aren't too surprised about that. And then the MEEP, and so if we create a shell of a MEEP thing waiting for someone to come and take it over, that might be interesting. It might be a project for next year to finish it up. But in all those, I think the 3 times coming into it, 3 times your premium going into it establishes a premium of the reserves you need. Because you have to have about 20% reserves. Some of the Minnesota plan escapes the 20% minimum threshold. Members have questions about that? Sorry, the audience has some questions.
I think that's the summary of what we talked about. Well, this is exactly.
And so if you have what I'd like from people, that person who's in PEEP, they'd be a anyway, that'd be a member. I'm really sorry about that. If you have ideas about how we could tweak the governance of that. And I think at this point, the bill called for a board. I think we'll stick with an advisory board that's under Dewar. That may make some sense in the future, since Dewar really doesn't have the purview over public employees, except for the state ones. But that could be at some future time spun out if it made sense. But I'm not interested in spinning it out at this time, and maybe not even next year. So, but fair enough, I'm trying to work out an open. With that... Now, I want to feel that so you would know how to react to some of those things, and if you want to, but you came to say, tell us something else. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and I just want to announce to people, I'm going to try to get done by 6:15 if that's possible. We have, so that may not be possible. I do want to hear all the witnesses. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Lori Elliott. I'm the Human Resources Manager for the City of Shoreview, and I also serve as the Chair of the Human Resources Legislative Policy Committee for the League of Minnesota Cities. And it's in that role that I'm here today, and I would like to thank you for inviting us to be here today, and I will do my part to get you out here by 10 after 6. So having said that, one of the things we were asked to do was to come and talk about the plight of cities and health insurance and what are some of the things that we're facing, and to do a little commentary on the bills before us this evening, or before you today. First of all, there are a number of health insurance providers. We don't really run into any problems finding someone who wants to quote us for insurance. And I would say Shoreview has 77 employees that can get insurance benefits. That's probably somewhere within the average of the 800-plus cities in Minnesota. People are more than happy to give us quotes and give us a lot of different options and a lot of flexibility. So we've got private insurance carriers that can help us with that, and there are also the purchasing pools. PEEP has been mentioned, plenty of times already. Logis or other service cooperatives as well. But there are the rising health insurance costs, and I see us and other cities really trying to tackle this in 2 ways. One is the consumer-driven health plans, and we're seeing fairly good number of employers, including Shoreview, have moved to a high deductible health plan. We did this in 2005. I can tell you that we were given a 16% rate cap for our renewal in 2006, and we actually saw a 6% decrease for 2006 in our rate. So the 10%, don't get too worried about that. Hope rises eternal. so that is one of the ways that we are trying to deal with our health care costs, is to deal with a higher deductible plan and putting more onus on our employees. The other tool that we are trying to do is, again, the lifestyle and wellness changes. I spent a considerable number of years pointing towards medical research costed money, and they were getting older, and that costs money, and people are living longer, and that costs money, and there's the Medicare, you know, we got to pay for that, so that costs money. And I finally, in the last couple of years, have changed my tune, and I now say to my employees, I've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. We're overweight, we don't exercise, we smoke, we drink. You know, we have a lot of control over what our health care costs us. And so now we need to start doing things on our end, and I'm not pointing the finger so much at the healthcare industry anymore, because I think really the next dollars to be saved are on our own shoulders. And it's rare that I have an employee walks in who is, you know, filling all the categories. You know, there's always something more we could be doing better. And to that end, we actually need legislative authority in order to fund wellness and health programs that encourage better lifestyles with our employees. And one of the legislative items that the League is supporting this year is a change to Minnesota Statute 15.46, not before you this evening, but when you see it coming through, please do give your support to that. And that currently allows counties to establish and operate programs that promote wellness and health risk management activities. But cities and school districts don't have that authority to spend money in that direction right now. So
they're going well.
I think it's been jacketed. I don't think it's been given a number yet.
There's not a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a short session. I think.
It seems like nobody would, that wouldn't be very controversial.
Hopefully not. I'm not sure how we got missed in the first place, but.
Just thinking floor amendment, you know.
Yeah. I'm all for it. It sounds great. But that's one of the challenges that we face, that to help us kind of get on the second side of reducing our costs. Other things that we do, and, you know, kind of sort of the question is, what are we doing to try to keep our prices, or try to keep our costs down? We also really encourage the minute clinics. And I can, you know, it's less than half the cost of going for an office visit to go to a minute clinic. We encourage the flexible spending accounts to save money, both us on Social Security costs as well as for the employee on taxes. We encourage the use of generic drugs. And, you know, we actually even, you know, put some information out there about the value of multivitamins. And in late 2003, the research came out that said, you know, approximately $1.6 billion in savings over 5 years on kind of the big five issues, coronary artery disease, diabetes, osteoporosis, prostate cancer, et cetera, as well as $2.4 billion in avoidable hospitalization for heart attacks. And these are big numbers. Yeah, and I'm like, wow. Maybe I should take my wellness money and give people vitamins. Maybe I'll save some on the retiree end. And these were long-term studies that really finally came out after 20 and 30 years of following control groups that took vitamins and didn't take vitamins. Some of the challenge that we face, and it was interesting listening to Commissioner Ludeman talk about the pharmacy benefit management. As a small group, I don't really have enough weight to tell my health insurance carrier, I don't want you doing the pharmacy piece. I want to carve that out and get that third, you know, that middle person out of there that is charging back room fees and incentives and promotions and all of that, and I want to just take that as a separate piece. We just don't have enough weight for 75 people. They're like, yeah, well, good luck with that. But those are things, those are the types of things that we're looking at and keeping our eyes open for, as well as there's been some movement in certified care centers where organizations have gone in and spent 2 to 5 days within a facility, talking from custodians to cafeteria workers to receptionists to doctors to nurses, all the way up the chain of command about processes, procedures, and systems, and what the costs are, what the mistakes are, and what they're finding as well. An upfront open heart surgery might cost more at this facility. There are less mistakes, less follow-up costs, back to work quicker. I mean, that in the long term, it becomes a cheaper operation to get them to a certified center that is fulfilling all of these components. And that's something else that, again, we're small, that if we ever had the opportunity to really sort of control and drive that, that I could get. And if I have a heart problem, I want to go to one of these places because I want to get back up and running as fast as I can.
You're saying quality actually matters.
Yes, quality. Yeah, and quality costs less. Yeah, you know, in the long run, quality costs less. So I think sometimes, you know, we get focused in on the front end dollar costs and the back end, kind of we lose track of that. I think it's important that providing lots of the options and the variety to local government is of value. We talked a little bit about negotiating with unions. You know, not every city is the same. It's not one size fits all. You know, Minneapolis is way different than Black Duck or, you know, Shoreview. Different needs for different groups. And as groups get older, they're going to want different kinds of insurance and different kinds of deductibles. As the high deductible plan stays in place and we work with health savings accounts, people become more comfortable with a higher deductible plan. So I think that flexibility as employee groups become more comfortable with it is really important. So anyways, moving on to, you know, trying to sort of follow you along as you talked about some of the changes you were proposing. You're just kind of going to be all like, yeah, we got that. I can move on. I'm good at that. I get the hand signals well. We do support the healthcare cost containment, what you're proposing for that in terms of easy access to information about costs and healthcare services. And I think even information about doctors that may have had suspensions or other, you know, other issues like that can be of value to people. And so long as costs for that are not ultimately shifted to cities or other government entities, and I think occasionally we end up on that end once in a while. And so that's something that we would be concerned about. With regard to the PEEP program, I heard your comments about people leaving who we lost money on, and then now you can't really recoup that loss. Some consideration that then what you're doing is encouraging poor groups to stay with you, and if I'm a healthy group, I'm not sure that I want to jump in with a group that's got a lot of high claims members to it. Also, I think concerns about, do I want to come in where I'm going to get penalized if I leave early or have to continue paying premiums? Because, again, this is somebody else's money I'm dealing with. This is taxpayer money that's going to continue to pay that. So a little bit of risk, I think, on that side as well. And then with the reinsurance pool, I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with another option out there, and there's nothing wrong with place to go. You never know. You never know. And I've worked in human resources long enough. You just never know what's going to walk through the door next. One of the things that I did see was about, we'll approve for reinsurance whatever our board says is okay. And I think it would be important if I was purchasing reinsurance that it's got to line up with my existing health plan. Because if my existing health plan says, yep, we'll cover, this surgery for obesity, the bariatric bypass, but the reinsurance pool says, no, we won't. Now I've got a real disconnect between the two things, and if I'm not reading the fine print, then all of a sudden I'm holding the bag on a pretty expensive surgery that runs, I think, around $25,000. So I think that's would be an important piece to me if I was looking in the reinsurance side of it to make sure I could line it up with my existing plan. And also the retrospective assessment backwards if I had bad claims again. Not something I would face with a private insurance company. So I think that also could maybe be a detractor to getting into that.
Questions? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Elliott, in your, I think you said you have an HSA now?
We have an HRA, yes.
And what's the maximum deductible for individual and a family? Or
well, we went really, interestingly, really conservative. We did $1,000 for single, $1,500 maximum. And then when you get into the family side, it's a $2,500 maximum, but no more than $1,500 per person. So if you have a family of three and your child gets in a significant accident, $1,500 is the maximum you'll pay out on that child, even though you haven't hit the $2,500 maximum. We also set up our pharmacy component to be a copay rather than part of the deductible plan. And general physicals are also covered at 100% because we really want to encourage people to get in, find these problems early, get them treated. So we went real conservative, and interestingly enough, we saw $365 a month savings between the premium that was quoted to us in our high deductible plan and what our renewal premium was. It's almost $4,300 a year for a family. Pretty significant.
So, I'll go to Mr. Chair, I would consider that those maximum out-of-pockets is reasonable.
Really low, yeah.
And do you put any money into the HRA? Or?
Yes, we do. We put $110 a month into the singles and $80 a month into the families. And I would, Shoreview is unique in that we are the only non-union city in the metro area. And so when we went to flip our organization, we needed to flip everybody. We only offer one plan. And there needed to be incentives for our city council. There needed to be incentives for people with single insurance who are currently paying no money. So why would I want a high deductible plan? I don't pay anything now anyways. No few offices are coping. And there needed to be the incentive for the families to get in. So it's really the savings account, the VEBA account, was the incentive for the singles. And the incentive for our council was we saved $151 a month on the single premium. We had 50 employees on single. So they saved $150 a month there. And we dropped their city monthly contribution by $75 a month. And that's the money we ended up putting into the VEBA. So they saw really a zero increase for 2005 and then a 6% decrease for 2006.
Last comment.
I was interested in your comments about you can't spend money on healthy behaviors. Can't you do that through your health insurance and give employees?
Yeah, if we invited them out to do a plan or to give some sort of a brown bag lunch, we can do that, yes. But if we wanted, you know, for example, if we wanted to set up a program where a weight loss program where, you know, everybody who loses 10 pounds gets $100. Or loses 10 pounds and keeps it off for a year, gets, you know, $200. Some sort of either a financial incentive or an incentive that has a value to it. We can't do that.
Back to Jerry Barley's company. He may be self-insured, but he gives deductions on what his employees' share of the premium is based on healthy behaviors.
I love rewarding healthy behaviors.
Up in a city. And thank you for coming. I think it's amazing that 10 years ago you wouldn't have found a city HR person who could have even done what you just did talking about this. You just, how much is it? I don't know, $800. It would just be, it's a whole different thing. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us.
And Ms. Hoffey, are you here? Okay.
Why don't you come up?
And there's a, John, I don't know that, why don't you digest what we talked about and, okay. Yeah, and you can certainly comment on Monday there'll be some amendments and you can certainly talk about those. So is Ms. Brace here too? I have a chair. Okay. So we'll have you'll get to be the last word tonight. Rebecca, hi, welcome. And if you would just want to take 5 minutes and say what's on your mind, and nice to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rebecca Hoffey, and I'm an employee and a benefits coordinator for Biotest Laboratories, a small, privately held corporation in Coon Rapids. I'm here today to represent the company and the employees of Biotest Laboratories to voice our support for HF 2831 as it relates to Minnesota Employees Insurance Program. Biotest Laboratories has had an employee population of just less than 50 until last year. The company experienced growth in business, which has resulted in the creation of 9 additional jobs. This is good news from a business and community perspective, but not as it relates to the ability of the company to continue to purchase health insurance for employees. Biotest Laboratories purchases health insurance for employees at a cost to the company of 85% of premium through the small employer group plan. We understand from our insurance agent that as of 2007, the company will no longer qualify for the small employer group as we have crossed the 50-employee threshold. We understand that the implications are potential significant increases in premium or denial of coverage. The assessment of self-insuring a group of 58 employees with 57% of the population over the age of 40 is that it would not be a viable option. The impact of losing employer-sponsored health insurance on our employees would be significant. It creation of an insurance purchasing pool for Minnesota employers, regardless of size, would benefit the employees of BioTest Laboratories and the workers throughout the state of Minnesota.
And just for the audience and members, this is exactly the kind of situation that I am challenged by, and this is what I'm trying to fix. And so you can see how you've been here for the whole thing. Right? You heard all the testimony. It's really hard, and you understand that. And you heard the city manager, the HR manager, with the gyrations they've gone through to tweak up everything. Members, have any questions? Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as when you hit that 50 limit, then you didn't talk anything about pursuing other quotes in the private market here for health insurance policies with other companies. You said you're correct, or did you?
Yes, happy.
You did pursue those?
No, we haven't pursued those. We are of the understanding from our current benefits agent that as of 2007, our premiums would have the potential of increasing significantly, or we could face a denial of coverage. It is our understanding that renewal of coverage for anyone outside the small group plan is not guaranteed.
Okay. Well, so then, you and your current agent that you referred to shopped other insurance companies for you?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not shopped. This is a relatively recent occurrence, and we are relying on our agent's expertise in this field for our understanding of the situation we face.
You're suggesting it's time to shop around?
It might be something you'd want to pursue. I'm not sure, you know, who you're with and, you know, what other options are available, but that's a common occurrence, I think, is 50 is the limit with most of the companies. And so things are definitely going to change, but then, you know, depending on all the other risk, you know, rating factors in your group, it could be he's got you at the best place, but maybe not. So it certainly would be, you know, something you'd want to pursue, I think.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Brad. Hi.
Rationale and has it changed over time?
Oftentimes
we get a number and we're stuck on a number, but it hasn't moved over a period of time.
Let's just make it 100. How hard could that be?
Mr. Chair, when the laws involving the small employer market were passed in 1992, it was 29 at first, up to 29. Then the legislature increased it to 49 and then up to 50. To comply with the match the federal some federal laws, and the reason it hasn't gone higher than that is it's been primarily a concern of interfering with what happens with larger groups and self insurance and so on and not wanting to affect that part of the market.
Go ahead, yeah, Representative Brown.
I'm wondering what the average size of a business has done over time, over that same period of time. Has it grown? Has it shrunk? You know, we often hear that people creating jobs are small businesses, but I'm wondering what the average size of a business has done over time, just to see if it measures.
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. Sorry.
Well, maybe we can have someone address that question now. Next time, maybe the plan. Mr. Bartsch can follow up with that. Well, thank you. Appreciate you coming in. And
appreciate the opportunity.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Ms. Blaze. Welcome. I haven't seen you for a while, so nice to have you come to our division here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I could almost say good evening.
Actually, it's 6:15. So.
Okay. I'm going to talk about your bill. I'm Twyla Blaze from the Citizens Council on Healthcare, And I'm going to talk about your bill 2438. And there are a few things that we really like, a few things that which are good but we think could use a bit of tweaking, and then some things that concern us. So let me just start with...
the good news first.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do, Mr. Chair. Page 12, line 32 to 33, which unfortunately in my notes I forgot to label what that was because I realize now that that would have been easier. Oh, the piece about premiums for a health plan subtractions from federal taxable income. And we think that's a great idea, but the question is why is it just for health plans? It just says premiums paid for a health plan as opposed to all insurers, or?
Mr. Pender, why do you do that?
I think we really, does that
have meaning?
We meant to do all premiums that are paid, right?
Mr. Chair, health plan is a defined term and includes a product bought from an HMO or Blue Cross or a for-profit insurer, so it covers the whole spectrum except for self-insured coverage. But since we're talking about individual health plans here, that's not wouldn't be relevant anyway.
Depends. Okay, and then
That's okay then by you.
Yes, thank you. And then page 14, line 15 is having to do with changing the regulatory authority to the Department of Commerce, and we've long been a supporter of doing that. Page 14, line 23 on charity care. That seems to be a fine provision, although when you say limited by federal law, I'm not sure if you got the whole thing there. I'm not sure why that's there, or you know what's that going to mean to people.
Let me explain this section. We're going to talk about this is actually a re-codifying of what we passed last year. So the drift of this is law now, and it was put into a section for convenience, and it was found to be confusing to people who were trying to abide by it and not knowing what it relates to. So this is pretty much a restating of what is already existing. So. Mr. Pender can comment about a specific of you think that we're vulnerable somewhere. Do you have a specific, like the federal thing that you're worrying about?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pender, you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Brace, some people express concern that federal law regarding Medicare billing might concern people and might conflict with some of the things that might be otherwise permitted by this provision, and so we can't overrule federal law. So it's just acknowledging that that federal law might limit the some things that people might want to do under this law.
So is that
Mr. Chair? My comment on that is just that I know that the Department of Health and Human Services actually put out a letter and some literature about the fact that hospitals and other clinics, clinics and other healthcare practitioners could actually charge a lower price. And I'm not sure that if by having that in there, because that was a statement by the Department of Health and Human Services in an actual letter that can be found online. I'm just not sure whether we help or we don't in that.
And yeah, that's the hospital thing? Is that the MyCatch hospital?
No, Mr. Chair. It was a letter that was put out by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Tommy Thompson.
Okay.
Secretary Tommy Thompson.
I just didn't know it's DHS. Because there was a move by to make hospitals reduce their rates to what? Some level, which I'm not convinced is legal without this kind of language, mm-hmm. frankly. So, they're going to get us that letter and talk to Mr. Pender.
Certainly.
I'm serious. That would be helpful.
Yep.
Okay. Keep going.
And page 14, line 32, which is the discounted payments by healthcare providers that affect in use. I think. I very much like the sound of it. It's not totally clear to me how it would play out, but I think it's a step towards building a cash-based system for most of healthcare, and so it certainly has a very good feel to it.
And this, again, is in law. It is embellished somewhat from the language that's in current law. This is what, if you listen to the tape, this is what we meant. We put the words to match what we meant. So maybe a third version someday to make it really say what we meant. So. Okay, keep going. You're doing that.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chair, we get to the tweaking.
That was the good news part.
That was. So page four, the pharmaceutical assistance programs. Rather than requiring, I guess I would say to encourage, rather than burdening clinics with this responsibility, encouraging them to do so, encouraging them to work with their pharmaceutical reps that come into the office all the time to leave that kind of information. Requiring is just one more requirement amongst lots of different regulatory and statutory requirements. So that would be my
suggestion. You're on the free information part. Is that right?
Correct, on the pharmaceutical assistance program.
I'm on the wrong page. Sorry. Okay.
So,
or the drug information.
Right, so I'm saying encourage as opposed to require. Because it's anybody's guess who they might have to pay or get to make, when you make it a requirement, how much extra cost it will be.
If you might say line 412, it does say free. Actually, without just 14 is, line 14 says free brochures. That's just meant to be a way to help people get the information about Part B in particular. Other free plans by different companies. So I appreciate it. It's meant to be a very low bar. There's a free stack of stuff. And so I respect what you're saying. So.
And then, Mr. Chair, page four, prior authorization. My comment on this is that it seems to me like we're trying to improve this whole prior authorization process. And I think that prior authorization by itself is the problem, and that if we engage people with their own cash, they would make decisions. And that this does not really, it's sort of like a statement. It doesn't seem to really do anything. And it doesn't stop the prior authorization, it doesn't stop the paperwork, it doesn't stop all the phone calls. It sort of asks for something to kind of happen, but it doesn't guarantee anything. So I'm just basically saying it toothless.
Stuff when I get to do, so.
Okay.
We're trying to find helpful HMOs helping our providers as they trying to try to remove some paperwork. That was the goal. Your point.
And
is,
my point is, I don't know.
We've actually figured it out too well. So
okay, keep going. Okay. Now, Mr. Chair, are the concerns?
Yeah.
As you know, we have long been concerned about evidence-based medicine, and I thought it was creative what you did here. In the evidence-based medicine section on page 3, I think what needs to be remembered here is, yes, we could have these health-related boards do all this, and we could have them meet this criteria, but all you have to do is listen to what happened today with the governor's speech, where he talked about paper performance, and to remember what was put into law last year, which was that providers would be monitored according to their performance with evidence-based medicine. And there is no agreement on what evidence-based medicine is, and there is no definition for evidence-based medicine. And so what you have in here is a lot of stuff that's going to be done. It'll take a while to get a guideline put out. Practitioners will be measured according to that guideline. There will be reports on them. It can take 2 years to create a guideline and lots of money. And so it's really what can happen for the patient is the patient can be penalized if the practitioner complies because they know they're going to get a scorecard according to whatever these groups decide, or the doctor's going to be penalized if they give the patient what the patient needs because their score is going to look less well. So it's really a no-win situation, and it's a whole lot of tax dollars being put into this initiative, and at the end of the day it's going to be very coercive to the physician. And despite what it says on line 20 of page 4 for the use of evidence-based standards, what you say there is that the health plan can't cite that as a standard, but they can cite it along with anything else that they want to, and it can just be backup for them. So that putting this in here, I'm not sure about the reason why you put it in here, but putting it in here doesn't mean that they can't deny health care and use it as part of their backup to do so.
Let me explain that just for your information. just both if you'd like. The whether I like it or not, people who function, who live in office out of Morocco are giving insurance companies, I guess my favorite place of the day, information and standards that are superimposed, are imposed upon us by people I've never met. And they judge care based upon these things. At least some different entity than the people I deal with normally. The intention of this, health-related boards and professional associations, doing it, at least if there's some people who know about what they're talking about and they're friendly to the topic and they understand how it could be used, if they do those standards, which they may or may not do, with not any government money, just at their own expense, at least they have to be based on some reasonable standards. That's the intent, and they could be adopted or not. At least there would be a competing standard with what's done by some other group who may be less informed. That's the intent, and I understand all your concerns. We've had this discussion many times. The other part, which needs to be rewritten, and we're working on a redraft of that, including not paying for clinical trials by inference or by accident, is that already plans have written, at least one person I know, if not more, saying that because there's no evidence to support what they're doing, they're not going to pay, based upon evidence-based standards, which to me is madness, because evidence-based, this has some evidence to judge, not no evidence to not pay. And so this would require them to have at least one negative study that would say that you shouldn't do it, compared to having no negatives come out. That's what this is supposed to get at. It's all the bad things that have to happen to what you predicted for the last decade. So this is one effort to fix some of the harm. And for good or bad, I don't intend to persuade you, just have to understand the intent of it. So.
Right, Mr. Chair. The only thing that I will then, and I did want to pass these out because it's our executive summary on evidence-based medicine, and I don't know who would take that.
Yeah. And is that the end of your comments on the bill?
No.
Oh, there's more.
I just wanted to
keep going with
to just keeping, just to add one thing to the record so that you understand that there's no clear cut about what evidence is. This comes from the Institute of Medicine in a book or a study that was called Patient Safety, Achieving a New Standard for Care, and this is a quote from that book. There are gaps and inconsistencies in the medical literature supporting one practice versus another.
I'll read that now, okay. This one, it's 628.
It's one sentence, Mr.
Okay, I didn't know. I thought you were going to read this one sentence.
There are gaps and inconsistencies in the medical literature supporting one practice versus another, as well as biases based on the perspective of the authors, who may be specialists, general practitioners, payers, marketers, or public health officials. That's the statement, Mr. Chair.
Is that
and
on page 2?
That is on page 2 at the very top. And, Mr. Chair, my...
You didn't catch up. I thought you were going to read me.
No, Mr.
It's
Chair.
It's been a long day.
My second concern is the medication therapy management. Two problems have to do with the privacy protection that I think you sort of wanted to put in there. I don't believe it's going to work for you, because I believe that as soon as you, the PBMs tend to be, as was already said here, a lot of times part of the insurance company. And that data can thus be shared as soon as you sign that you want insurance. And so we're thinking of, if you ask the patients, my guess is that they wouldn't be happy with all that information going to even a pharmacist that's part of the PBM. And then the other concern is that you require monitoring and evaluation of the patient, and really what you're doing is you're adding a second practitioner. It's almost like having two doctors taking care of the patient at once and having perhaps a lot of conflict even between what kind of medication that they're going to get. So I think it's not a good medical practice to put someone and require by law that someone be so involved in the person's care and may or may not be any part of their rest of their medical treatment.
Okay. That's not a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you can provide this to me separately. Now we're getting tight on time, but I'm interested in, if you want to move towards a cash-based system, what evaluation mechanism you feel is appropriate? There's got to be something there for consumers to grab onto in terms of making their own evaluations. If you could just provide me your view on what is appropriate, what standards are appropriate, or what solution is out there in regards to something separate from evidence-based medicine, which is something that I'm just looking for other.
So you can.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, so that's a discussion you can carry on even yet tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, you're doing well.
Mr. Chair, the next thing is just a general statement about all the new reporting that you have in there. And my concern, of course, is that
which reporting?
Administrative efficiency of health plans, reporting on charity care, reports on evidence-based protocols, adding to the website, building the website, planning for reports on acquired infections. And, really, all of this sort of thing is going to grow the government. We're not into growing the government. And we're into having cash so that these entities that you want to keep track of so clearly actually have to prove themselves to the individuals who have cash rather than proving themselves to the government and costing a lot of extra money that will never go into health care. And then, Mr. Chair, page 9, line 17, the limited liability, and I will admit that I don't know a whole lot about that, but I just wanted to say it is better, in my opinion, if I understand it in the least, is to, rather than protecting private entities with a government shield, to have the same liability, to have the government have the liabilities of private entities. And then the last
that'd
thing
be novel. that'd be more popular, certainly. It'll be the exact opposite. And this is the ambulance piece. And,
And then charity care is my last piece.
That works for me. But.
I believe lots of ambulances might be owned by health plans as well. charity care on...
Head shaking going in there. That's the record show, head shaking in the back room. They don't own a lot of ambulances.
Charity care, page 6, line 28. I'm just going to say that it looks like an administrative nightmare for those who will be required to comply with this section. And I wonder, this is just a rhetorical statement, I wonder how much charity care could be provided at the cost of actually having to do this procedure to follow this law, to figure out all the accounting over the year, because it seems like a nightmare to me. And we want people to be able to provide charity care. And rather than increasing the number of staff that go into reporting, to increase the number of time of staff that go into caring is our preference. And I do have an amendment for that section. A proposed amendment for that section, which is, and you might find this of interest as well. Charity care, this is what I say as one of the things that it does not include. Charity care does not include the difference between gross charges and negotiated cash payments for care, except for the difference between payment received and the lowest payment received by contractual arrangement. Which means that if the charge is, for instance, we'll just say $10,000, and a health plan has negotiated down to $3,000 or $4,000, and the patient negotiates to $2,000, the charity is $1,000.
You have Mr. Pender and he'll
I believe a lot of these charity care things are already in rule.
Yes, Mr. Chair, some of that long section is in...
just the information, your information, the intention of this section, as clumsy as it is. So when the hospitals come to us and say, we've given out so many millions of dollars in charity care, we know what they're talking about. It's exactly as you said. It's a very fuzzy number. So, anything else?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else want to stay longer and talk about more things? I don't. You've been very good to stay. Give yourself gold stars. I'll see you all Monday. We're in room 200 on Monday. A little bigger room for more people to come. We're adjourned. Thank you.